This is a fairly lengthy and rather thought-provoking parable from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a householder who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into the vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and to them he said, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever's right I will give you." So they went. Going out again about the sixth and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, "Why do you stand here idle all day?" They said, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You go into the vineyard too." And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his steward, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the householder, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity?" So the last will be first. First, last, and it's not fair in the least. It illustrates, short of matters of life and death, one of the most malignant of human emotions. That is, when you find out somebody else got something you didn't even know you needed, but once you found out they had it, you felt entitled to it. And you walk around with a bleak look and a cloud in your head and a bad attitude for no other reason than you learned something that you might not have even been entitled to know. I have to confess that I walked around Texas Tech University with a chip on my shoulder for about 6 years, when about 10 years ago we hired a mid-level faculty member who had gotten and finished the PhD the same year I did, but just between you and me, hadn't published enough, hadn't published as much, and whose teaching scores weren't quite as high. And for reasons that the dean put forward somewhat persuasively, and I was on the committee that signed off on it, this person got hired in at 20% higher than me. 20%. And of course, the rationale at the time was a rising tide floats all boats, and this will be the rationale for, dealing with and coming up with strategies to expand the salary compression a little bit. Yeah, well, my boat stayed in dry dock for 6 years. And then it started to move up. And I don't even know if it's completely equitable yet, but it would depend on how you define equitability. But I have to tell you that finally I took a breath and said, what difference does it make? Now, that was not easy. I said I had a chip on my shoulder for about 6 years. And if you push me into talking about this long enough, it'll come back, because it's not fair. See, it's called relative deprivation, because there is no deprivation in reality. It's relative as we understand it in our own hearts. And that's actually a psychological term, a sense of relative deprivation. Well, how do you get past that once you know? Well, I actually, as a professor, I came up with an essay test. So I want you to imagine you got little blue books in your hand. Take out your little pencils. Put your name in the upper right-hand corner, And I want you to answer in your mind, and I'll kind of walk you through this a little bit, the answers to these essay questions. Imagine you are a little bit put out over what I've just defined as relative deprivation, same kind of thing the people that worked the whole day for the money they agreed to work for and then felt a little put out that other people were treated unfairly. Ask yourself this question. What's changed in your life from before you knew that till now? What's changed materially, socially, economically for you? What's changed? Once you learn something that you might not have even had the right to know, but now that you do, you're feeling put out. Back it up a second. What's changed in and of and only in your life? That's what kind of moved me off that chip. Because the answer to that question, I would have to leave the answer blank. Nothing's changed. Nothing materially, socially, economically. Only the bats that fly around inside my own head, interpreting the good fortune of somebody else and feeling put out about it. Nothing has changed in my life. So I have to leave that one blank. Second little essay question. Roughly how much of what you really need in your life do you already have? That's kind of interesting. It was true 10 years ago when this whole kerfuffle started that I drank hazelnut coffee, which is way more expensive than coffee ought to be because I like it. If I wanted it, I drank upscale wine. If an appetizer or a dessert appealed to me at a restaurant, I ordered it. Sometimes I even ordered the filet. And the bank didn't break. That was true then. It's true now. All the bills got paid. A little extra left over. Nothing that I really needed in my life then or now was what I didn't already have. The only thing that was different was my way of looking at how much more I thought I needed or wanted. And then you take a breath and another little chunk comes off the chip. Roughly how much of what you really need do you already have? And that hasn't changed. This one is, I think, even more interesting because it is clinically proven to help deal with depression. You ready for this? Next time you feel relatively deprived, ask yourself, what portion of what you have could you give away today with minimal ill effect? What portion of what you have could you give away a little bit more? Maybe even give it away without anybody knowing. That's called a mitzvah. You know, the metaphor for what a mitzvah is, and it's hard to do because they don't have much of these in certainly towns like this, but imagine you're walking down the street of a big city and you see a couple of expired parking meters. You plug the parking meter so the person who's parked there doesn't get a ticket and you don't know who they are. Or when you're going through a toll booth, you pay your toll and say, oh, this is for the guy behind me. It's a mitzvah. Then the guy behind you tries to catch up and go, you know, it's kind of interesting. But that's what a mitzvah is. That has been shown. That plus a big bite of chocolate. A bite of chocolate and a mitzvah is very effective antidepressant medication, especially if the mitzvah is a secret. So what portion of what you already have could you give away with minimal ill effect? At least some. I went to a stewardship workshop many, many years ago when at this time of the year churches start talking about stewardship. And I thought this was an especially useful way of not only pitching stewardship, but just thinking about your own life and the blessings you have. The biblical standard for stewardship is the tithe. And nationwide, we don't come close to that in terms of charitable giving. 1 or 2% is much closer to on average. But it doesn't even matter what that is. What I learned at the stewardship workshop was a question to ask one's self. Could you this year, in terms of your overall charitable giving, increase what you did last year by 1% of your income? Doesn't matter where you start, maybe at zero, but 1% times 10 years over time, you know. In other words, can you live today on 99% of what you've been living on? And if you can't, maybe you've got bigger problems. But if you can increase by 1% your generosity, maybe even without anybody knowing, that also is useful for the bats that fly around in your own head when you're feeling relatively deprived. Here's the next essay question. Generally speaking, what are the three best things you've got going in your life? Wasn't hard for me to come up with that. I am eligible for Social Security and I still can play softball. My health is good enough for that. Not bad, I'm telling you that right now. So that's one. And that's just dumb luck. It's just being fortunate that my health is good enough to keep doing that at my age. Secondly, I get paid to do what I would do for free. I have one, well, don't take that too seriously. I have one skill. I can talk. It's all I know how to do. I've told my family, I've told my students, I've told some of you, the only skill I have is I can give a pretty good 10 or 15 minute talk. And a lecture at school is just a sequence of those. It's exhilarating to me to exchange ideas with people and to get feedback and then raise new questions. I get paid to do what I would already do for free. That's pretty darn nice. I've told students, find out what you love to do and see if you can pay somebody to do it. And if you get that, that's your calling. I'm pretty lucky. And thirdly, the third thing is I have people in my life that really do love me anyway. And there are times when I push that envelope. It's not conditional in my home. It's not conditional with my grandkids. And I am unaccountably blessed that there are at least a few people in my life that love me not if, but anyway, and are a sort of metaphor for what the Bible tells us Jesus is all about. Which reminds me now of another essay question. When in your life have you been given something or had something happen to you that you flat out did not deserve? When the officer gave you a verbal warning and you were speeding and you knew it. I mean, that's sort of like the parking meter metaphor. When you have perpetrated a horrible lapse in character, when you have violated the terms of your own values and were forgiven by the people that love you anyway, as it were. Well, that's the whole point of the story. We are all beneficiaries of great generosity on the part of other people, on the part of the world that put us in a place where we can live out our calling. And ultimately, what we believe Jesus will do for us even at the last day. I think of the Ten Commandments as a guide for life, you know. And how good are we at approaching the reality of holding up our end on the Ten Commandments? I also find it kind of interesting that only three of the Ten Commandments are actually violations of civil law. Perjury, homicide, and stealing. The rest of them refer to the social nature of our lives together, and it's in the social nature of our lives together that relative deprivation shows up anyway. But let's think about the big one. You know, let's imagine you're trying to broker your way past St. Peter at the Pearly Gates by saying, you know what, at least I never killed anybody. Until you reread Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, where he says, you have heard it said to the men of old, you shall not kill. But I say unto you, anyone who says, you fool, to his brother, shall be liable to the hell of fire. I got no chance. None of us do. And yet, we have every chance, only because he says, you're still worth it. So the next time relative deprivation puts bugs in your head, essentially ask yourself one last essay question. Do you truly begrudge the Savior's generosity? Take a breath, take what you have, maybe go have a glass of upscale wine or at least a bite of chocolate and say thank you. Thank you.